First Coast Connect. Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, filling in for Al Letson, who's out of town this week. We're coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. Today, a closer look at the historical significance of Jacksonville's consolidation and how many of these same issues impact our city today. Plus, the Jacksonville Women's Network is hosting their 24th annual speaker forum. And Jaguars? Real or animated? But first, a story that's been getting a lot of traction since the release of an investigation Friday into a high-powered Republican insider. Kent Sturman took his own life in December while he was the subject of a criminal probe. Our guest, Nate Monroe, broke that story. The Florida Times Union columnist joins us now, and you can join the conversation too at 949-2937. You could also tweet us at FCC on air and email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Good morning, Nate. How's it going?
It's going great, Ann. I hope it's going great for you, too.
It is. We're still kind of getting our sea legs here, but happy morning. Happy Monday. So, Nate, this report has been in the works for months, and it finally came out Friday, much awaited. Tell us a little bit about who Kent Sturman was and how this investigation began in the first place.
Sure. I mean, you know, Kent Sturman was kind of an insider's insider. This is not someone who was a household name in Jacksonville by any means. He was someone who had ingratiated himself to powerful people, both in the city and in the state. I would say what was interesting about Kent Sturman is that the way he did that was not the typical way that a lot of kind of insiders become close to powerful people. He was a political donor, but not by any means the wealthiest donor or the most prolific. He didn't give these huge sums of money that we sometimes hear about. And yet he found himself, I mean, he could have credibly claimed to have been among the closest, if not the closest, kind of advisor that the governor had in Northeast Florida. Hmm. And so he had just sort of established these sort of deep relationships with people like the governor. He was also very close with the former sheriff of Jacksonville, Mike Williams. He sort of did that despite not being, you know, just this, you know, again, like the kind of real money man behind a lot of these guys.
Mm-hmm. But definitely a kind of a deep insider. So this investigation began shortly before he took his own life in December of last year. And then the investigation continued after his suicide. Why didn't it end when he took his life?
So the state attorney's office continued investigating Kent Sturman for about 10 months. And the state attorney said that they'd continued to do so to try and figure out if he had victimized any additional women. The underlying charges in the investigative report describe a situation where Kent Sturman had kind of sought to coerce a young woman by luring her in with potential VIP access to a Taylor Swift concert. That was the only incident that investigators found. They did not find any other women, despite there being sort of rumors of this in the kind of immediate aftermath of his death last year.
Mm-hmm. And so the state attorney released this information on Friday and chose to make a lot of information available, really all of the supporting documents, all of the interviews, including with the victim and her father. Why do you think she chose to handle it this way? Why do you think she chose to release proactively so much of the investigative material?
Yeah, I mean, I think they do this from time to time when they are handling a sensitive investigation in which there has been a lot of kind of public interest. And I think that this one certainly qualified. I also think that I don't want to speak for them, but I think the proactive release of information may have also had the effect, intended or not, of I think maybe pushing back against there was just a lot of speculation sort of out in the ether after Kent Sturman's death. Just given the nature of who he was the fact that he did have friends in high places. I think there were people who maybe suspected that this investigation would not be thorough, or that there would be some effort to cover things up. And so I think the state attorney proactively releasing all of this information, and it really was a pretty exhaustive amount of information, frankly, I think it had the effect of sort of pushing back on that kind of speculation. And I think, pretty effectively, this was a very thorough investigation of Kent's activities.
And I think it's important to clarify, because after you did some of your initial reporting, I think there was wild rumors that this offense that he was accused of somehow involved children. It did not. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the young woman at the center of this kind of troubling story about Taylor Swift tickets, she was in fact significantly younger than Kent Sturman, who was 50. But she was not a minor. The investigators have not released her exact age at the time that these alleged crimes were committed, but we do know that she was not a minor. Mm-hmm. So she was not under 18. And that has obvious implications, both in a legal context and also just in the way that we as people probably view the story. And it had been that there were some reports that she was a minor at the time. And so there was some confusion, and especially in those earlier days, about the age of this young woman. Mm-hmm. But we do know that now. She is not a minor, or she was not a minor.
And the conclusion of the investigation was that had he lived, he would have been charged with several criminal charges. Is that right?
Yeah. The prosecutors outlined about four or five different charges they were considering. Most of them were kind of misdemeanor solicitation for prostitution. There were a couple of different sort of forms of fraud. The most serious charge was a kind of unlawful imprisonment charge, which would have been a third degree felony and could have carried some jail time and a pretty hefty fine. This is a very serious issue, and the state attorney's office, I think, certainly sought to communicate to everyone in their disposition report that they viewed it as such.
And that, given that he had such close ties to elected officials, including the governor Ron DeSantis, the former sheriff Mike Williams, and also our former mayor Lenny Curry, does any of this impact them?
I mean, that's probably something that's maybe a little bit above my pay grade for the moment anyway. I don't know. I will say there has also been a lot of kind of speculation, and frankly, this is just kind of a matter of some subjectivity about how close was Kent to some of these people. And I think no more pointedly than how close was he to the governor. There is no doubt that he was a bit of a confidant to Ron DeSantis. I myself know that, and other reporters, were in positions to be able to confirm that too. I think there was always this question with Kent Sturman, though, about whether he sometimes oversold mm-hmm. the kind of access and influence that he had to some of these powerful people. And I've never really been able to answer that question to my satisfaction. As some other reporters out there, I've had some opportunities to talk to Kent over the years, and I certainly got the impression that he was he could be kind of braggadocious about his connections and sometimes even about his wealth. And, I think there was, I certainly got the impression from time to time that might have been the sort of person who was happy to really play up his connections. Mm-hmm. But, that's a sort of a different question for a different day in some ways. He absolutely did have a relationship with the governor and with some of those other elected officials. And, to the extent voters decide to hold those connections against them, I guess we'll just have to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nate, we, of course, appreciate and love your reporting. Thanks a lot for joining us this morning to kind of give us the lowdown on this investigation.
Of course, Ann. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Bye.
Welcome back. Yesterday, the consolidated city of Jacksonville turned 55 years old. On October 1st, 1968, the city of Jacksonville merged with Duval County, forming a massive 874 square mile city, the largest in the contiguous United States. That move was driven by business leaders and civic activists who said it was necessary to eliminate the duplication of government services and clean house after a series of scandals and grand jury indictments. Chris Hand is a government law attorney, the former chief of staff for Mayor Alvin Brown, and the author of the most recent update to a definitive book on Jacksonville consolidation. It's called A Quiet Revolution, The Consolidation of Jacksonville-Duval County and the Dynamics of Urban Political Reform. Hey, Chris, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning, Ann.
So for those of us who don't know what consolidation is, what it accomplishes, what is consolidation?
Well, like you said, it was the merger of a city government and a county government. In this case, the former city of Jacksonville with Duval County into what is now the consolidated city of Jacksonville. And I think it's important, you sort of set the stage in your introduction, but just to remind people how consolidation came about, where the city of Jacksonville and Duval County were in the mid-1960s. The St. Johns River was considered maybe hopelessly polluted at that point. The school district had lost its accreditation. We had a very Byzantine governmental structure. We had both a county government, a city commission, city commissioners as well, budget problems at the city, and as you said, numerous local government officials who were indicted for corruption charges. So when local leaders came together trying to find some sort of solution to that cascading series of problems, what they came up with was trying to create a more efficient and accountable government by merging Jacksonville and Duval County to form what is today the consolidated city of Jacksonville.
And so this is a historical marker. It's 55 years ago, but why is it important, do you think, for Jacksonville residents to know about the history of consolidation?
Well, I think the best way that we make sure that our government is responsive and operating at the levels we want it to going forward is to have some understanding of where it came from, and also what was promised at the start of consolidation. I think one of the benefits of having these 55 years of history is we have a sufficient body of data at this point to be able to analyze what have consolidation's strengths been, what has its weaknesses been, what are the areas for improvement. And I think there has begun to form some consensus on those questions, Anne. One, in terms of its strengths, it certainly is more efficient. You know, there are counties in other parts of Florida that might have 30 municipalities. Here, we just have one local government entity if people need to interact with the city. I think there's some sense that just because of the structure, there's the potential for government to be more accountable as well. But there, I think, is also some consensus about some of the weaknesses of the consolidated model also. But for consolidation, we would have probably had a town of Durkeyville or a town of Arlington or a town of Mandarin. And when you have an 874 square mile city, as you said in the introduction, it is very easy for the government to become very large and monolithic and not as focused on the individualized needs of individual neighborhoods. And we see that in a variety of ways across the community, but I think most poignantly in the unfulfilled promises of consolidation. The promises of that if consolidation were to pass, made during the 1967 consolidation campaign, that people could expect significant upgrades in infrastructure, having septic tanks converted to central sewer, sidewalks built, roads paved, roads lighted, improvements in drainage and in drinking water. And in many parts of Jacksonville today, those promises still go unfulfilled. I think thus, again, sort of highlighting some of the concerns about how individual neighborhoods have potentially fared under the consolidated model.
One thing that I was surprised at, and I was looking through this very thorough book that you did the most recent update for. I think it's gone through several iterations now, and it really is a deep dive into a lot of the city's history. But I was surprised to see how long back the push to consolidate dated, back into like the late 1800s. They were trying to, you know, come up with a way to consolidate city-county functions. I'm curious what it is, if there's something unique about this area that lent itself to the sense that it needed to consolidate. I mean, you say, you know, obviously there's a lot of counties that have multiple municipalities and function, you know, kind of as well as anywhere else. Is there something unique about this area that you think was eager to bring itself under one umbrella?
Well, you make a very good point, Anne, because, you know, there were numerous attempts to achieve consolidation before it actually occurred in the late 1960s. I think most notably in the 20th century, there was actually a vote on consolidation in the 1930s that was unsuccessful. Around the same time, other Florida...
Maybe even two votes.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And you know, around the same time, other Florida cities were sort of considering this as well. I think there's probably a number of factors. One is the fact that we live in a in an area where there is one considerably large jurisdiction, and that's Jacksonville. Two, I think the nature of the crisis in the 1960s is sort of what ultimately pushed this over. But again, it's a model that other communities have adopted as well. While there aren't a ton of consolidated city counties around the country, places like Louisville, Kentucky, Indianapolis, Indiana, Denver, San Francisco, California. So there are a variety of examples out there. Jacksonville was one of the first and most prominent. And when this occurred, it was really hailed and sort of ballyhooed as this incredible local government reform. That day, just over 55 years ago, October 1st, 1968, really was a moment of celebration in the city of Jacksonville. Of course, now over the sweep of 55 years, we've had the chance to really analyze and see how consolidation, how that structure has worked in practice, and so really are able to assess kind of the benefits and the costs.
I know that we have a caller, I believe, John on line two. He's got some questions about consolidation and reinstituting public interest in the issue. Good morning, John. Are you there? Stand by, John.
Hey.
Hey, John, are you there?
Hello.
Hey, yeah. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Ann, and thank you for taking my call. Chris, always good talking with you. Let me just give you a little background real fast. There was something up on the Hard Bridge, so I am late now, going to the Neighborhoods Committee meeting at 9:30.
Oh, boy.
And public participation, you know, that is the ability to address or legislative representatives before a vote is taken on any pending legislation. And, you know, that has been taken away from the Jacksonville City Council Legislative Committee process. So anyway, you know, I'm on my way to the meeting, but going, you know, it was in our charter and it was an opinion of the Office of General Counsel. And we're getting a new guy, you know, that just started. And so, you know, Chris, my big thing is, will you, the administration, who's going to reinstitute the public trust by being able to address?
Hey, John, you're getting a little windy on us right now, so I'm going to pass the question to Chris to kind of take what we've got from your question and move on.
Well, John, thank you very much for your question. And I certainly remember John from my time at City Hall,
sure,
where he was very active in trying to participate in public comment and committee meetings, full council meetings, Waterways Commission. I know that's a particular interest to John. But, you know, I think John touches on a really important point, which is that, you know, I talk a lot about effective citizenship and say that the most important role in democracy is citizen. And if you were to design the optimal organizational chart for the city of Jacksonville, at the very top of that chart would be the citizenry, people who city government are supposed to represent. And John, I heartily agree with you that it is very important that multiple opportunities be built into the system for citizens to be able to engage with, share their views with, help make their elected officials respond to concerns. And I think that's particularly important with consolidation. As we sit here at this 55th anniversary, remember that consolidation was created by citizen votes, and the way it will be revitalized or improved over time is through citizen voices. So to the extent people do have recommendations or suggestions or questions about our consolidated model, please share those with the mayor's office, with your district council person, with your five at-large council members, with your constitutional officers. Make sure your voices are heard. But that absolutely should be a bedrock of our consolidated government, the ability for public and the citizens to participate.
That's right. It would be great if a lot more people were running to their council committee meeting this morning.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
One thing that stood out to me in the reading this book, looking back at this history, was the fact that the political revolutions in this city's history have often been carried by the business establishment. And in the case of consolidation, which I more than I thought or perhaps remembered, by the media. I wonder why you think that is, as opposed to perhaps a more grassroots source for that kind of change.
Well, it's interesting. When you go back and look at the history of how consolidation came about, what I find interesting about it, Anne, is how many different sources and not just the 1960s version, but, you know, go back to the 1930s version, how that part came about. Well, it came about, if you kind of look at the original treatment, and the original version of A Quiet Revolution was written by Richard Martin, who was a Times Union reporter and ultimately the first public information officer for the city of Jacksonville. But as he explores that 1930s push, what motivated people to get involved was people were trying to petition city council as it related to budget hearings, felt like council was not being responsive, and that led to some citizen activism that ultimately produced that first consolidation vote. It wasn't ultimately successful right then, but obviously was over time. What I find interesting about the consolidation period is how many different influences there were that went into that. No question the local business leadership was involved, but you also had sort of good government advocates. For example, the person who was the executive director of the, you know, the local government study commission, which produced the blueprint for improvement, was Lex Hester, who ultimately ended up becoming the chief administrative officer for multiple administrations,
mm-hmm.
was sort of known as Mr. Government for many, many years, ultimately a mayoral candidate. And as you say, the media had a huge role. WJHG
huge role.
Through its, you know, Government by Gaslight mm-hmm. series, and others as well. So I think what's interesting is there were a lot of different sort of inputs into the consolidation process when it occurred in the late 1960s.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, this dates to when the Bold City of the South moniker was created. The city really did feel like this was a very bold step. And it sounds like they thought it was going to be a model of government for, you know, other cities, other counties to look at. Do you feel like the city has held on to aspirations to be a bold city?
I think it depends a lot on how you sort of look at the issue and sort of the, I mean, I think one thing that I think is important to remember about consolidation is that for the most part, it's a structure. It's how you design the government. At the end of the day, that structure is only going to be as bold and as effective as the people who are kind of serving in elected positions and where they choose to take that structure. I think there have been big moments in Jacksonville's history that would probably not have been possible but for consolidation. For example, you're going to talk a little bit later on the show about the Jaguars game yesterday. Jacksonville probably does not land an NFL team in 1993, but for the fact that they were able to marshal the community in the sort of consolidated model we have and achieve a team at that point. That said, I think on, you know, if you look back, and I referred earlier to this issue of unfulfilled promises, in my opinion, one of the biggest impediments to Jacksonville achieving its full potential is the fact that the benefits of consolidation have not yet been extended to the entire community. That does not mean that there have not been efforts to do that over time. There have been mayoral administrations, Mayor Delaney and the Better Jacksonville plan, the enhanced gas tax, even during the Curry administration, just the most recent one we've had. Mayor Deegan has talked a lot about it. So there have been efforts over time to address these, but there hasn't been a sustained effort over time to make sure that every neighborhood in Jacksonville receives the benefits of consolidation that were promised. I think that level of boldness to make sure that citizens receive what they were promised in the 1967 campaign is something that I think city leaders need to look very hard at going forward.
Do you think it's too fine a point to put on it to just say that it really comes down to money? Because you see this theme again and again throughout this book and Jacksonville's history of fees and programs, the River City Renaissance, the Better Jacksonville Plan. You know, Mayor Payton passed three new fees on stormwater and I can't even remember the other two, but and trying to find a dedicated funding source, as you say, or as our friend Nate Monroe likes to say, it's a tax. But that all of these things that were promised are so expensive, whether it's phasing out septic tanks or, you know, making sure that roads are, you know, properly maintained. Does the city have enough money to meet the promise of consolidation?
Well, I mean, certainly at the moment, the city's in a much better financial situation than it has been in the past. I mean, during the time I served in City Hall, the statistic I like to give is that in the first 2 years of our administration, ad valorem revenues dropped by $50 million, while our pension obligations increased by $50 million. The last part of Mayor Payton's, his second term, kind of very similar situation. So the city's definitely in a better place now. But I think this all comes down to political will, mission, and planning. If there is a community determination, not just by city leaders, but also by the business community, as you mentioned earlier, and other community stakeholders, that we think it's important to make sure that every citizen enjoy the benefits of some of these infrastructure improvements we're talking about, as were promised during the 1967 consolidation campaign. And by the way, that's not anecdotal. I interviewed people like Alton Yates, who's a community hero, who was part of the consolidation campaign and can give firsthand testimony to the promises that were made. But with the right political will and the right mission and strategic plan and, as you say, dedicated funding source, a lot of these issues can be addressed. I should also point out that we're in a moment right now where there are a lot of other resources. The federal government just in the last 2 years passed a major infrastructure bill that is providing funding to local governments to help address some of these issues. There's been state money to address some of this as well. So it's going to require vision, leadership, a mission, planning, and ultimately some dedicated funding to make sure that every neighborhood all across, and this is not just one neighborhood or another, no matter where you are in the city, whether you're in Northwest Jacksonville, East Jacksonville, Mandarin, the West Side, some of these infrastructure challenges persist throughout Jacksonville. It's really a community-wide problem and demanding a community-wide solution.
And I think it's something we talk about more these days, and the book doesn't shrink from acknowledging the fact that race was a part of the consolidation push, that there was a sense that the city of Jacksonville was moving towards being, you know, possibly led by a Black mayor. It was a 40% Black voter population, and the surrounding white community was concerned about that race really did play a role in that. Is that sort of an original sin of consolidation, or is that something that we can learn from and understand and move on and still, you know, kind of understand the foundation of it, but not let it hold the city back?
I think among many citizens, it is something that has significantly affected the credibility of consolidation, because I think there's some perception that there was a bait and switch here, that some neighborhoods, primarily Black neighborhoods, were told, all right, in this new model, you're going to lose some political power, but here's what you're going to gain in return. You're going to gain, work on these kind of longstanding infrastructure problems that will help improve quality of life. Well, the political power shifted, but there hasn't been the commensurate sort of change in some of these infrastructure issues, as we've talked about. So I think that has affected the credibility of consolidation with some. I don't know that we can just say, well, sorry, that didn't work, and we just have to move on. I think, again, for Jacksonville to be able to move forward in the strongest possible way into the future, the community's got to make eye contact with the fact that as we talk about in the book a little bit, we've sort of written a tale of two cities when it comes to the 55 years since consolidation. Rewriting that tale to make sure that the benefits of consolidation extend to the entire community, I think, is a very crucial aspect to Jacksonville realizing its future potential.
And one of the things that you spoke to a number of people about when you were doing, you know, your addition to this book was the sense of neighborhood. And, you know, you hear that a lot. People move to Jacksonville and sometimes they never go north of Bay Meadows or they never go, you know, outside of Riverside, Avondale. It's such a big city. There's so many diverse communities. Was that sense of neighborhood accountability, neighborhood identity somewhat squished or lost in consolidation?
Yes, I think particularly at the governmental level. I think that's one of the trade-offs, those cost benefits we talked about earlier. When you have a government that's responsible for, you know, up to 875 square miles, there's the danger of becoming a little bit monolithic and not giving that individualized attention to individual neighborhood needs. Now, again, that's not to say that's always been the case, and there have certainly been administrations and councils that have attempted to do that. And there are some structures set up at the city to try and give neighborhood voices, like the CPACs and other sort of citizen involvement tools. But I think that's, I think, a fairly well-recognized weakness of consolidation. Have there been some suggestions over time about how to deal with that? For example, there's been efforts to, there is actually a neighborhood bill of rights that was actually passed by council in the mid-1990s, but has never actually shown up in the city of Jacksonville ordinance code or the charter. There have been some suggestions that actually go into the charter and perhaps even be revised to include some of these infrastructure issues. So there's a very clear neighborhood bill of rights going forward so that the city has to follow certain guidelines and adopt certain principles in dealing with neighborhoods. There have been suggestions to strengthen the CPAC process, that citizens have an even more meaningful role. When I was interviewing people for this book, there were some former council members who suggested giving neighborhoods more of a direct voice in things like land use and zoning planning, and giving them some funding that they can use to invest directly in their neighborhood. So I think that has historically been a challenge with consolidation, the focus on neighborhoods, and there's been some back and forth on that. But there's a number of interesting suggestions that I think are worth considering going forward.
And given, you know, all the conversations that you've had around this and your thoroughgoing knowledge of, you know, the history of consolidation, when we get to, you know, 100 years of consolidated history, what do you think you would like to see, you know, happen in the period between now and then to strengthen the consolidated government or to see that it better lives up to its promises?
Well, first of all, I hope I'm here at the 100th anniversary. I hope we're all here at the 100th anniversary to see kind of how it is at that centennial. But I think there's a couple of things. One, as we talked about earlier, making sure that consolidation, if it still exists at that point, is something that is truly benefiting the entire community, that if you're going to represent 875 square miles, make sure that no one within that jurisdiction isn't receiving the benefits of consolidation. But I think also a little bit of a shift. You know, when consolidation was created because of all those factors in the 1960s, I know early mayors, and I spoke to Jake Godbold about this when he was still alive, early mayors felt a lot of pressure to really kind of lean into those benefits of efficiency and accountability. So, you know, for example, the millage rate was cut, you know, kind of year after year. They certainly tried to make government as efficient as possible, which is a great, I mean, important goal for any mayoral administration. But I think one of the ways that you have to balance that over time is, in addition to the efficiency and accountability, is the city investing in itself in the right ways? Consolidation actually provides an opportunity to do that because theoretically, with a consolidated model, you ought to be able to divide, you know, come up with community wide goals, missions, and get the entire community on the same page about those, have a strategy, and again, find ways to invest in those community wide goals. One irony about consolidation is that even though we are this sort of large monolithic government, I think sometimes Jacksonville is known as a community of silos, where people are working on a variety of different things, not necessarily in concert. One of the things I'd like to see is, if we're going to be consolidated, let's be consolidated in setting goals and priorities for the community and consolidated in helping to make those happen over time.
Well, Chris, so much appreciated that you're sharing your expertise. Thanks a lot for being here today. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. And we're back. We want to start with a little news this segment. The Hart Bridge, we understand, has been closed this morning due to what is being called a maritime incident, according to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. FDOT inspectors are preparing to inspect the structure currently, and police say it will reopen the bridge once the bridge and the structure is deemed safe. Drivers currently are encouraged to seek alternate routes, such as the Main Street Bridge or the Matthews Bridge. All right, so the Jacksonville Women's Network is hosting its 24th annual speaker forum this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., and here with more details are Angela Timberlake, Jacksonville Women's Network board member and forum chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Brianna Kilcullen, founder and CEO of Enact and this year's keynote speaker. So good morning. Thanks, both of you, for being here. Barbara, can you give a little background on the Jacksonville Women's Network?
Yes, I can.
Excuse me. Angela.
Okay. Yes, it's Angela. Sorry. I am here on behalf of our president, Barbara.
I gotcha.
Yeah, so I am the forum chair this year, and I am here on behalf of the board and our entire membership. And the Jacksonville Women's Network is an organization that is made up of women from all areas of the community who are brought together by invitation to lift and support other women in the community. So our mission is to really use our influence to elevate and give voice to women across our community.
And kind of what is your membership? A little bit about how the organization got started?
Yeah, it was formed in 1979, and it is a nonprofit organization. And it was formed by women who saw an opportunity and a need for women supporting other women. And so that we had resources and a connecting network to bring voice to women of influence across the community. So we know that when we lock arms as a community, both men and women, that we all rise. Mm-hmm. And so that was the grounding principle around the Women's Network.
And so who currently is part of the network?
Yeah, so we are made up of, we have a board who is all volunteer. And then our members are brought in by other members. So you are nominated and invited by our current membership. So those who have the credibility and the influence across the community. So it's made up of women from business owners to executive leaders to nonprofit leaders to education and hospital administration. So it's just women in all walks of leadership who are making a difference in the community.
And so what's the purpose and the significance of the annual speaker forum?
So the speaker forum is our opportunity to give back to the community and really get the community involved in supporting other women. And so when we started searching for our speaker this year, it's one of the ways that we can really give back and promote women. And so the names were coming in and you know, Brianna's story just spoke to us, and we said, you know, what a great opportunity. And the work that I do every day as president of Elevate Women, it's, I know how critical it is to bring a voice to women that don't have an opportunity to break through the leadership here in Northeast Florida. And so we wanted to give that opportunity to Brianna and also have an opportunity to lock arms and bring the community together to support her.
So I'm going to turn it over to Brianna in just a second, but why don't you tell us a little bit about what it is that she does and how it is that she addresses the focus of the speaker forum this year?
Yeah, so she had an opportunity to make a difference. And so she saw something in the world that she felt like she could make a change. And so that story really rung true to our committee and said, you know, if somebody could make a difference and go off and do it on their own and find ways to really overcome all the obstacles and still succeed, then that's a great story that we want to tell, especially somebody right here in our backyard.
Awesome. Brianna, tell us a little bit about your company, Enact, and how did you get started? And tell us a little bit about what the business does.
Yeah, so Enact is short for an act of kindness, an act of goodwill, the simple act of creating impact. I wanted to create a movement within the brand, and my background was working in corporate brands like Under Armour, Prana, Columbia Sportswear. So I grew up in Jacksonville, left, worked in the textile industry. And then coming back, I wanted to create, to Angela's point, I saw a gap in the textile industry and how we were designing products and how we were disposing of them and what we were making when we were using them, mostly synthetics and conventional cotton. So I wanted to use a natural plant-based fiber like hemp, and I wanted to design for end of life, and I wanted to create a community around the product and the brand and the vision of what we were doing. And so coming back to Jacksonville and doing that and being here is really exciting. So I just want to say thank you, Angela, and for having me. But Enact, our larger vision is, how do we bring manufacturing back to the U.S.? So how do we have sustainable products that are better for people on the planet, that are chemical and dye-free, but also how do we have farmers grow product here and manufacture and distribute to the sales channels that we're selling to? So it's innovation and disruption around supply chain infrastructure, as well as better for you products, and having our community be a part of it while we do it.
And so is your company kind of an end-to-end? Like, are you involved in the manufacture of the products? And tell us a little bit about what your product line consists of.
Right. So we were designed and developed here in Jacksonville on Kickstarter. And Kickstarter is what propelled us. And then from Kickstarter, we organically started ranking on Google for hemp towels. And so then we started getting orders and press inquiries all over the country and the world. And from there, that allowed us to then, we sell D2C and then we sell wholesale. We now sell on Target, Wayfair, Amazon. We just launched at REI. And so that has been like a huge driver for us, is our organic rankings as a company. But right now we do an entire bath towel line, wash towel, hand towel, bath towel, and then we do a wearable collection. And we're actually working on a Made in America product at the moment.
And some of this involved working to legalize hemp production in the first place. Is that right?
Yes. So when we came back, hemp had not been legalized in Florida. So we worked with former Ag Commissioner Nikki Fried to pass that legislation, because we wanted farmers to have the opportunity to grow in the state and for that economy to be possible and as a cash crop for here in Florida.
That's awesome. Angela, so if people want to learn more about Brianna and learn more about the Women's Speaker Forum, where does it take place, and how can people get tickets?
Yeah, so we tickets ended last night. Our ticket sales ended last night, and we are to almost a sellout crowd. So we are very excited about that. It's on the Jacksonville Women's Network webpage, and you can go there and check us out a little bit more. If anyone still wants tickets, they can reach out to me directly,
awesome.
And hopefully we'll have some seats.
Thanks so much. We've been talking with Brianna Kilcullen, founder and CEO of Enact, and Angela Timberlake, Jacksonville Women Network board member and forum chair. I'm Ann Schindler, and you're listening to First Coast Connect. We'll be back right after this.
WJCT Public Media invites you to an evening with Amna Nawaz, co-anchor of the PBS NewsHour. Amna Nawaz will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, on stage for an enlightening and engaging conversation. Tuesday, October 3rd at WJCT Studios. VIP reception is at 6 p.m., followed by the presentation at 7. For tickets and more info, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm Carol Hills. Searching for El Nino Guerrero, a notorious gang leader who escaped from prison in Venezuela. Governments across South America are on the hunt to find him.
He is the head of Venezuela's largest homegrown criminal structure.
The elusive crime boss is on the run. Next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, electronic music producer and DJ Jennifer Lee, better known as Toki Monsta. She's considered a pioneer in electronic music as the first female Asian American producer to garner a Grammy nomination for Best Dance Electronic Album. She talks with us about her musical path and the near-death experience that changed the course of her life. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
New science is revealing how astonishing our senses are. We can hear amplitudes smaller than an atom. Our sense of touch is molecular, and we can smell a trillion scents. Next time on 1A, we meet two super sensors who say there's more to learn about how we see, hear, smell, touch, and taste.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hey, welcome back. The Jaguars faced off against the Atlantic Falcons yesterday at Wembley Stadium in London. Alessandra Pomprian, sportscaster at our partner News for Jax, is here with the tea in the studio. Welcome, Alessandra. How's it going?
Thank you. Well, it's Victory Monday, so it's a good Monday morning, except I got stuck in traffic detouring over the bridge, so that was not great.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a little bit of traffic issue out there still happening.
Yeah, unfortunately. But you know what? Jaguars won back in the winning column, 23-7 win over the Falcons. It was a good win for them. Progress was definitely made on the offense. Defense, they did a very stellar job. And then special teams came up, scoring 9 of the 23 points. That was really good. The only touchdown on the offense, at least, was Lawrence to Ridley the first quarter. That was the first touchdown in the first half of the past 3 games.
Wow.
And the emphasis this week was to start the game fast and get out, obviously with an early lead early in the game. And that's exactly what they did. So that was very good. I was proud of the offense. You know, they've made progress. I don't think they're where people still think they should be, but they made progress yesterday. I think Trevor Lawrence played very well. The running game wasn't the best, but Christian Kirk stepping up big, and both Evan Engram, Kirk and Evan Engram did a great job. And, you know, for special teams, Jamal Agnew, the returner, he was out. He was ruled out of the game. So the backup was Parker Washington. On his first play of his first NFL game, he suffered apparently what now they're calling a significant knee injury. So he'll be out. So then they had to go to the third string, basically, on, you know, for their third choice for a returner, who's Christian Kirk. Of course, they'd rather have on offense primarily. So now he will be the returner. So not amazing when you know, he's a key guy in offense as a receiver. You don't really want him as a returner as well, just in case he gets hurt. But, the offense did, I think they did very well. Maybe people are a little more critical on them, but I think Trevor Lawrence did well. And of course, Evan Engram stepped up big, and so did Christian Kirk. So.
And a nice psychological boost for the team, I guess, to have a win.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They definitely did not want to go. So they're 2-2 right now. They definitely did not want to be 1-3. That would have been really bad. But the real stars, I would say, were the defense. Mm-hmm. First quarter alone, let me look at my stats. They had 4 sacks in the entire game. 3 of those came from Josh Allen. This is his second 3-sack game of the season.
Wow.
Which is very, very good for him. And then 2 interceptions, one of them from Darius Williams for a 61-yard pick 6, and then Andre Sisco coming in for the other interception. So, yeah, the defense did very, very well yesterday.
That's awesome. And so the Jags were back in London yesterday, and they play again there next weekend. So what's with this back-to-back overseas venture that they're trying out?
Oh, yeah, it's the first time, and the first team to try this out, that played 2 back-to-back games in London. This is actually, I guess, they're going into their 11th international game or in London. So they have the most international appearances out of any team.
Huh.
Yeah. So they'll play the Buffalo Bills, who had a very good game against the Miami Dolphins last night or yesterday afternoon. So yeah, so it should be a good game.
Uh-huh.
It'd be a tough one.
So I watched some of the game, but I admittedly did it via the Toy Story live animated version on ESPN Plus. And so what are you hearing from fans or players about the toy avatar version of the game?
I thought it was great. So of course I was watching the actual game broadcast, but I did see like the Trevor Lawrence to Calvin Ridley touchdown pass, or when Trevor Lawrence erupted for like almost a 20-yard gain on the ground, the flames that were coming off the shoes. I thought it was great. You know, it was cool. It was a great way to get kids involved with the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a different way to broadcast it. So why not? I thought it was awesome, though.
I actually thought it kind of spoke to me too, since I'm not a big sports head, you know,
that's
having that
thing,
like
yeah.
little spoon-fed what's happening.
Knowledge, right.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about Toy Story, so like I didn't really know all the characters, but I thought it was great. You know, I think they probably will incorporate this, you know, later on.
And so what do you think we can look forward to next Sunday when the Jags take on the Bills? What are you thinking, especially after yesterday's Bills performance?
This is going to be a hard one for the Jags. Absolutely. The Buffalo Bills, very good. You have 2 Josh Allens on the field. One, of course, the linebacker for the Jaguars, then the quarterback for the Bills. So everyone always says, you know, you can't have 2 good Josh Allens on the field. You can only have 1. So hopefully Jags fans, you know, your Josh Allen is much better. So, but if he has the same performance as he did against the Falcons, you know, it should look good.
Uh-huh. And are you going to be able to get over to London for one of these?
No, unfortunately, we're not going to London. I'm going to catch up on some sleep this week, which is much needed. And then they come home and they were going to host the Colts. So second week second time this season that they'll be playing against the Colts. So.
And I had understood that perhaps they're looking to do an away game and a home game in London. Is that how they're going to try to work it?
Yeah. So against the Falcons, they were quote unquote the host.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah. If you want to say that, even though of course they're both away. So they're quote unquote the host. This week, they're actually moving to a different hotel because the Bills will be the quote unquote host this week. So then the Bills are actually moving into the Jaguars hotel that they were just in. I think that I don't know why
they would.
I know, that's what I was saying. I was like, I think that's kind of silly to move. You know, you're already in the hotel, so why not stay there? But whatever. I guess that's the host hotel, and that's what, you know, that's where they're staying.
And fans generally, you think, still accepting of that arrangement that we've got with having them play home games abroad?
I think they like it. And it's great for them to get out. They got the win. So London was necessary, I think.
Right on. Well, thank you, Alessandra, so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests today and our executive producer, music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey the Brain Bennett. Our associate producer is Kathy Waterman. Our director, Brady Corum. Our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas. If you've got questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. I will be here again tomorrow with former Duval County School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. We'll pick the conversation back up then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.